Hey, good morning. Welcome to Your Turn. I'm Mike Fossey, and glad to have you with us here on Wednesday at 10 a.m., as we are every week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Reminder that our shows are archived on our homepage, so if you miss this, miss part of it, or in this case, you probably will want to hear this one a couple of times. We've got a lot of information. You can do so at your leisure and tell a friend about it, too. My first guest is John Grobe. He is a veteran of this show, been on a number of times, in town on other business from Chicago. Where John, what do you do? What's your thing?
I do a lot of pre-retirement training as well as career transition training for federal employees, and that is indeed what I was in town for, doing a pre-retirement seminar Monday and Tuesday.
And you're a former Fed yourself?
I am. I spent 26 years with the Feds, with the Postal Service, and with Treasury.
Okay. Now, what we've—it's funny. We were talking with Tom and Tom Timmon and Emily Kopp earlier today about this show and about things. And Emily raised a good point. She said these threats have been around forever, or many of them have, and yet nothing has happened. True, in most cases, the thing that's, and correct me if I'm wrong, the thing that's different now, I think, is the climate, the way the country's heading, even though it's a Democratic administration and the federal unions had hoped for much better treatment. The unthinkable has happened. You've had a pay freeze, not for 1 year, not for 2 years, but we're entering our third year of a federal pay freeze. Sequestration, the unthinkable, happened. We're seeing the results of it now. Furloughs in some agencies, some are offering buyouts, and some are talking about layoffs, reductions in force, beginning October 1. So the climate has changed, hasn't it?
It has. I think federal employees might think they're in a bad dream right now. It's a confluence of different threats. But as you mentioned, many of these things have been proposed before, and they haven't happened before. Of course, we always know what has or hasn't happened. If we knew the future, I suspect you and I wouldn't be in the studio. We'd be on the beach somewhere sipping a piña colada.
Yeah, I'm always saying if things work right, we'd have to get real jobs. But
yeah,
Fortunately, they don't. Another factor, you've got the Simpson-Bowles Commission. President Obama appointed it a couple of years ago. Former Senator Simpson, former White House aide Erskine Bowles. Their idea was to be like a BRAC, that Base Realignment and Closure Commission, and that is this blue ribbon panel, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, would come up with a list of proposed savings. If they approved it, it would go to Congress, that it would be an up or down vote. And like BRAC, it would take some of the sting out of the political sting out of this for members of Congress. They didn't reach agreement on these points, but everybody said, and it turns out it's true, this is the template. This is going to be the thing that people keep referring back to when they look at ways to save money in the government. And sure enough, some of the ideas from Simpson-Bowles have surfaced again and again and again. Start out with a couple here. You mentioned an unholy trifecta? What's your
I think
term?
I called it the kiss of death.
Kiss
trifecta.
Okay, that'll get their attention. Kiss of death trifecta. Start off with some others. And it's interesting, in the people who cover the federal beat, we are all usually surprised that this is a number one fear of federal workers, because it hasn't happened, it's been around a long time, and B, its impact would be minimal, but it's something people can grasp. And that is switching from basing your retirement on your highest three-year average salary to the high-five system. And this seems to upset an awful lot of people, probably the majority of them. What about it, and what are the odds of it?
Well, I first heard about the switch from high three to high five in the 1970s,
yep,
when I was a young letter carrier.
Yeah.
And it has not happened yet. We do have both Simpson-Bowles and the House Republican budget calling for that. I don't think we have quite the kiss of death, because I haven't heard the White House calling for it yet. And if it happens, I have to emphasize the word if. It's probably more likely to happen now than it was in the early 1970s. I expect that Congress would engage in extensive grandfathering. I would be inclined to think that every federal employee on the rolls would be grandfathered into a high three.
Be prospective.
If we look back to last year when they raised the retirement contributions for FERS employees, that legislation was passed and signed in the summer, and the change did not take effect for anybody who was on the rolls at that time, and in fact, not for anyone who would be hired up to and including the 31st of December. It was only prospective for people hired January 1st of this year and after. And I would expect they would do that to most of these proposed changes.
Well, and a couple of points, too, on the high three to high five. A, it hasn't happened yet. If it does happen, it's likely to be prospective. So there are many people who have said, well, I'll retire, I'll quit before it goes into effect. Well, they probably wouldn't have to. And B, it's not that big a deal financially. People have crunched the numbers, and it's a matter of a few dollars a year, in most cases, less that people would start off getting.
When Simpson-Bowles first came out, I did some number crunching. This is back when, silly me, I thought the freeze would be in place for 1, maybe 2 years. Mm-hmm. The effect of a one-year salary freeze was worse than the effect of switching from a high three to a high five.
Okay.
The effect of a three-year salary freeze has to be significantly worse. That affects your high three. Of course, if we went to a high five and had a salary freeze, that would be even worse.
Even worse. Number two on your list, not in any necessary order of importance, but the possibility that the pay freeze will be continued for yet another year. What do you think are the odds?
Well, when you see how fast the White House dropped their proposal for a half of 1%, and now they're proposing 1% raise, I think if the going gets tough, this one will be dropped again. I hate to think so, but if you look at past performance, that's what they did.
That's
they
right.
dropped
and,
it before.
And the President's Simpson-Bowles Commission did propose a three-year pay freeze.
And the House Republican budget, five.
Five, right. And the White House sort of compromised on two. Now it's three. Okay, changing the amount of retirement contributions by current employees, not future, but current employees. So you're paying what now and what would it go to?
You've got three different perspectives from this: Simpson-Bowles, the White House budget, and the House Republican budget. All of them want to somehow increase federal contributions, but we need to look at the level of federal contributions. If I'm in the old system, if I am CSRS, I am contributing 7% of my salary, and Uncle Sam is contributing 7% of my salary as well. If I am in the FERS system, I am contributing 0.8% of my salary, and Uncle is putting in about 11.9, a significantly higher percentage. Now, for both systems, special category employees such as law enforcement and firefighters are paying slightly more, and I don't want to overlook the hybrid CSRS offset system, where they are putting in, just like FERS, 0.8% compared with Uncle's 11.9. So it depends whose proposal you're looking at for increasing retirement contributions. Simpson-Bowles calls for equalizing retirement contributions between the employee and the employer. That would not affect a straight CSRS employee. Their contributions are already equal. It would affect CSRS offset and FERS. If you compare 0.8% to 11.9%, you're looking at 1/14 versus 13/14. So Simpson-Bowles is in effect calling for an increase of 7 times in what people are putting in. The House Republican budget calls for an across-the-board increase that would affect people even in the old CSRS system, but it is silent as to the amount of that increase. And then the president's budget. I guess the president's budget was the latecomer to this party. And it is calling for an increase over a three-year period of 0.4% per year. And that would apply to both systems. So at the end of 3 years, when these increases would end, pension contributions on the employee's part would go up by 1.2%. That would make it 8.2% for CSRS and a flat 2% for both CSRS offset and FERS. None of those look very appetizing, although if I were a CSRS person, I guess I'd be rooting for Simpson-Bowles because that wouldn't affect me.
Okay, take a short break here on Federal News Radio, and we'll be right back. Cozy Air. Welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with John Grove. He's come in from Chicago to be with us today. And, John, you have a book out there.
Yes, I recently wrote a book entitled Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees. It talks about what federal employees should look at if they're actually thinking of making a change, perhaps due to these threats or perhaps for another reason. Things
sure.
like weighing their benefits here and elsewhere, what would happen to federal benefits they had already accrued, and it has a little discussion of federal retirement in there as well.
Yeah, and the workforce has been and is getting older, as we all are, but the federal workforce in particular is getting older. So, we wanted to make the point, and I think it's good of you, that this is supposition here. We're not reporting that any of these things is going to be eliminated. What we are saying is that they've been out there for years, at least some of them have, and they haven't happened yet. On the other hand, the pay freeze, which was unthinkable, has happened, is in its third year. The furloughs, which we didn't think were going to happen, have happened and will be happening. So a lot of the things that couldn't happen have happened, and the climate has changed. So we're giving you this rundown. And number, I guess, four on the hit parade, if you will, eliminating the FERS supplement. This is a big deal, and I think very few people understand it. What's the FERS supplement?
The FERS supplement is a payment that a FERS retiree will receive between their minimum retirement age and eligibility for Social Security, which is age 62. Now, there are some exceptions to it. Law enforcement yep. and firefighters can receive it early. And, you know, if I retire at 62 or later, it is a moot point. But this is something that was created back when FERS was created to kind of bridge the period of time between federal retirement, mid to late 50s, and eligibility for Social Security, age 62. The supplement is generally based upon the number of years of civilian service that an employee has. If I had 20 years of civilian service at the time I retired, my supplement would be one half of my estimated age 62 Social Security benefit.
So that could be a chunk of change.
It could be. Some people might think without a supplement, they are doomed to work until 62.
Okay. I mean, this could run into the thousands of dollars a year easily, right? And the idea behind this plan is to eliminate that.
And we have not seen a lot of push from Congress. We've seen some people who I like to say are one or two standard deviations off the norm
yeah.
proposing eliminating this for current employees. But what is perhaps just a bit frightening, although shouldn't be frightening for the current federal employee, the White House budget proposes eliminating the supplement for new federal employees.
And that would be a tremendous savings to the government, a tremendous loss to the retirees. And in this case, these are new people who are retiring after the effective date of this law, if it becomes law.
Yeah, well, I don't think they would eliminate it for anyone who was on the rolls
okay.
today, that it would only be for new hires. So the effect would be quite prospective, but it would certainly affect the government's ability to recruit and retain talent. Our benefits are among the best recruiters
yeah.
that we have.
You know, I wonder about that because I agree with you that the benefits package is a major draw for people. But I suspect, I'm guessing, that people in their 20s and even their 30s aren't thinking about retiring, about ever being age 62 and thinking about a FERS supplement. But I may be wrong. Okay, we're getting into the heavy stuff now. This is the one that federal unions, NARF, the retiree group, organizations that represent federal workers or look out for them have warned this is the big enchilada. This is the tough one here, and that is switching to something called the chained CPI. Could you explain that?
Yes, our current consumer price index, the one that is used for all federal inflation-adjusted benefits, it's based on the consumer price index for urban wage earners, and that consumer price index assumes that if the cost of one item goes up, we will not substitute. If I have an orange every morning, I'm going to continue to have an orange
no
every
matter
morning.
What the price
right.
rises.
Right,
okay.
Even if all the orange crop in Florida is killed by frost, the chained consumer price index assumes that if the price of an object goes up, I am going to make a substitution. So the chained index assumes that if the price of oranges goes up at least a few days a week, I'm going to have apples instead of oranges. I'm going to adjust my spending based on the consumer price index going up. Two organizations, NARF, Advocacy Organization for Federal Retirees and Employees, and the Congressional Budget Office have stated that if the chained index had been in effect for the last 10 years, pensions and other benefits would today be about 3% smaller. Now, we have to realize inflation has been modest over the last 3 years, and over a 30-year retirement, which is not going to be uncommon, that could be a 10% or so reduction. I think the people who are really going to be hammered by this are disabled veterans, someone who comes back from Iraq in their 20s and has 60, 70 years of veterans benefits that are going to be affected by this. And this has the kiss of death trifecta. It's got the White House, it's got the House Republican budget, it's got Simpson-Bowles all lined up behind it. But on the other side of the ball, you've got some of the most potent lobbying organizations in the country, led by the biggest dog of the lobbyists, AARP.
What is it? They call Social Security the third rail of American politics. Touch it and you die. And in this case, the thing about it, you know, most people are familiar with compounding, but we think about it as a positive. Your money compounds over time, but things compound in reverse too. And in this case, if you got a COLA that was, say, 0.4% less than you would normally have gotten under the old system, if you get the lesser COLA under this chain CPI, over time that compounds and adds up very quickly, doesn't it?
It does. It's the snowball effect. You can use that same rule of 72 that people use for dealing with estimating return over a long period of time to estimate the effect of inflation. At a 3% rate of inflation, the purchasing power of a dollar turns into 50 cents in 24 years.
Okay. And the irony of all this is that if it were to happen, we're assuming there's going to be a major fight over this. As you said, you have powerful groups on both sides, but you do have the White House, the Republican budget group, and Simpson-Bowles all behind this one. So that's a potent group in of itself. But if this does happen, before long, people wouldn't really know what was happening to them. They wouldn't. You can't miss, if you will, what you don't get.
That is true. That's an excellent point. That if you're not receiving it, how do you know what it is? And I think a danger to federal employees, well, to anyone who's going to be affected by proposed changes, is if Congress goes about it piecemeal. If this goes as a package where they have to vote on a bunch of changes, I think we stand a better chance than being the death of a thousand cuts.
Okay, back to the trifecta in a minute. Take a short break here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Benefits expert, former Fed, author of a book on how to transition into retirement, and we've been running through the possible hit list that's facing federal workers. And John wanted to stress that these are things that have been around for a long time, for the most part, and they haven't happened. There's nothing imminent about them, but they are on the radar scope, and the administration, the Congress, and the Simpson-Bowles Commission all support one or more of these things. So the odds of something happening are certainly greater now, I think, than they've ever been, even though it's not time to panic. John, the last one on the list is one that I think again, a lot of people have overlooked because it's a little hard to understand, but it's a voucher system for the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. And under it, and correct me if I'm wrong, if this were approved, the government would give you as a worker or you as a retiree X amount of money with which to buy your insurance, and then it would be up to you, to, of course, to pick it. And that would determine there would be no government share as such. You would be picking a plan on your own?
Yeah, this was first proposed by Simpson Bowles using a euphemism for a voucher system, which is premium support plan. The way I understand that it would work is federal employees would, as you said, be given a fixed amount. If they could find insurance that was satisfactory for them for that amount, they would literally be paying nothing for their insurance. If, however, they wanted a plan with lower deductibles, higher comprehensive, so on and so forth, they would be paying progressively more. So that was Simpson Bowles. The House Republican budget has called for a premium support plan for, of all things, Medicare. So premium support plans are at least being talked about, although the White House hasn't said anything. In fact, the White House had something interesting with FEHB in their budget, which, of course, was the latecomer to this party. They suggested that we go to offering a self-plus-one option in addition to self-only and self-and-family. Don't know how that will fly. Doesn't seem to have support from either of the other groups.
Yeah, many people have rejected that in the past because they think it breaks up the idea of a group plan. That is, older people subsidize younger people who are having children. Younger people subsidize older people who have more aches and pains. The healthy subsidize the ill, but be that as it may, that's out there. But this voucher plan, the idea, too, is the government would give you a certain amount of money. And now each year, each time health insurance premiums go up, the government share of the payment remains constant. It's about 72% on average. Under the voucher plan, that would gradually shrink. The government share could, if you picked a good, expensive, what they call Cadillac-type coverage plan, you would wind up paying more of it yourself or the difference.
Yes, indeed you could. I don't think we have any Cadillacs yet in the government, but we do have some pretty good-sized Buicks among our plans there. So that is certainly an issue. And Simpson Bowles, when they first proposed it, called for adjusting the government contribution by a percentage of GDP, which I suspect would not be equal to the increase in health care costs themselves.
Very good. John, you want to kind of sum up here? It's been a great rundown, and we appreciate it.
Well, I don't want to have all the listeners leave here with their heads hanging and being all depressed. I think I really need to add at the end of all of this, don't panic. I don't think all of these are going to happen. As we've mentioned a couple times, this is speculation, and it's good to be forewarned about speculation. But one thing with the federal government, when they go through changes that affect employees, they do it in a deliberate manner. Employees have plenty of advance notice. Compared with layoffs and so on in the private sector, federal employees really do have it pretty good.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, John, for being with us. We're going to do this again and wish you a good trip back to Chicago. And we'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back with Steve Watkins and Steve Losey from the Federal Times. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. This is a fun part of the show. We'll be talking with Steve Watkins, editor of the Federal Times, and Stephen Losey, senior writer, and sort of get a roundup about what's going on. And there's so much stuff going on. And maybe just I'll leave the studio. You guys just tell just talk. What's happening?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that's happened last week is the announcement of the new rules. The proposal of the new regulations for phased retirement. Now, this is something that the Office of Personnel Management has been spearheading since early last year. This has the potential to represent a fairly major change in how federal employees retire and how federal managers conduct succession planning, prepare for the wave of retirements that is just, it seems to be starting, the ball is starting to roll on this retirement wave. So basically, in a nutshell, how phase retirement would work is this. Rather, if you're eligible to retire, Mike, rather than saying, okay, I'm gone, see ya, and walking out the door, you kind of switch into a part-time status. You work half the time, but you also earn half your pension. So you are able to kind of enjoy your retirement a little bit, but if you're not ready to hit the links 5 days a week, you can still wrap up some projects. This is important. You can still mentor younger employees who are going to replace you, and you can add just a little bit more to you, to the pension that you will earn when you finally once and for all completely retire. So this is fairly interesting. The proposed regulations came out last week. The public has 60 days to respond. And after that, OPM will make some changes to the regulations. And so it may still be some time before people can actually enter into phase retirement. So it's not going to be something that's happening right away. But this is something that is definitely coming down the pike. It's on the horizon. And I know there are a lot of federal employees, because I've heard from them, who are interested in taking this phase retirement option.
Yeah, I have. And I know that one thing I think a lot of people are saying, as soon as this is effective, I'm going to go in and tell the boss I'm doing it. It doesn't work that way, right? It's their call.
That's right. Your boss can't force you to enter into phased retirement, but also you can't just dictate to your boss and say, I'm entering into phased. The agency and your boss has to agree, okay, this makes sense for you to work part-time. Maybe we need you to wrap up a certain project you've been working on. Maybe we need you to teach the young guns, you know, where the bodies are buried. So it has to be a mutual agreement between you and your boss and your agency.
You know, as Steve said, the whole intent of this is to try to stem the brain drain to some extent, and also to mentor a lot of the new employees coming on so that they can quickly get their arms around the job. But if the agency doesn't have the money, and that's obviously that's the big problem of the day. A lot of agencies aren't going to be able to hire the successing employee as well as the replacement employee as well as keep that Fed on the job to train them.
Well, as you mentioned, the retirement tsunami appears to have started. This build up, the numbers are increasing. Office of Personnel Management forever has had a backlog in that processing application because so much of the stuff is paper and must be eyeballed. They've done a good job of cutting into the backlog. But now they're getting this increased wave of retirements. You've got the problems with they were offering buyouts. They had to stop overtime payments because of sequestration. So if I'm getting ready to retire right now, should I be nervous?
I think, yeah, there is cause to be nervous. As you said, OPM is really knuckled down on this pension backlog, and they've made considerable progress. They had a backlog of 61,000 cases back in January 2012. They've knocked that down to roughly 26,000 last month. They have taken a big bite out of it. The thing is, a major way they did that was by just drastically ramping up the overtime. And back at the end of April, the OPM announced that because of the sequester budget cuts, they were really trying to avoid furloughs, so they cut out all overtime. And May was the first month in which we saw the results of those overtime cuts, and they were considerable. The number of pension claims processed dropped from almost 13,600 in April to shy of 11,000 in May. That's quite a drop. That's the lowest in several months. So it's having a real effect. And in recent weeks, the OPM has dropped another bombshell. They are planning to offer buyouts and early outs, almost 300 across the agency. And that's going to include buyout offers to 17 of their most experienced retirement services employees. Now, OPM's already gone through a process of adding something like 76 more people in their pension staff, both to process claims and answer calls from the public. And if you cut out 17 of these people, that's gonna deal a blow. I mean, because it takes some time. It takes several months to bring these new people on, train them, get them to the point where they know the ins and outs of this. It can be complicated, this retirement system, calculating these pensions. So that's going to be a major loss to OPM when they lose those 17 people. And again, this is all driven by budget cuts and the sequester. So we're starting to see some real-world impact of these sequester budget cuts.
Well, you know, that says a lot, too, about the federal government and the scope of it. You know, we think of the government, we think of jillions and trillions and billions and hundreds of thousands of people here and there, and yet here's a situation where losing 17 people could make a big difference in a really important program.
Yeah, and, I mean, the number of people who I can't recall off the top of my head how many people they have processing these claims, but it's a couple of dozen, really. So it's a small amount of people that have a considerable impact on, you know, tens of thousands of retirees every year.
And the deal is, if I'm going to retire, I put in my papers, the agency gets them over to OPM, and it literally is papers, paperwork, and things like that.
Sort of. It's now
my track record.
It's they've scanned these documents, so they're in PDF form by and large. But for the most part, for documents before 2005, they're not in what I call kind of smart data.
Yeah.
Data that a computer can go in and pluck out the numbers that you need. It's a PDF that a human being has to open up in a OPM's piloting this new project called the Data Viewer. They open up the PDF, they look, and they say, Mike Causey has X amount of years, he's got X, his high three is such and such a dollars, and they have to eyeball those figures. Now, OPM is working, they're planning an ambitious new IT project that's going to try to improve the calculation of these numbers, and eventually they want to have it to the point where computers can pull all these numbers, but because they're so many older feds whose documents are still in just this PDF form, we're likely not going to see a complete and total automated pension processing system for decades.
I was going to say, it'd be decades, yeah. And when I retire, you retire, the agency or somebody at some point makes the judgment, say, hey, how much are we going to give this guy on an interim basis until we get it all straightened out? And what is the target figure? Usually, is it 80%?
It's roughly 80%. That's what OPM says now. The interim payment.
But
is
I know
in that
you
range.
And I both probably it was a different person. But I think we've talked to people who got as little as 40%.
Yeah. There's some nightmare stories out there. There are some people who say I've been waiting more than a year. I've gotten a quarter of what I'm owed. And those are, from what I understand, those are kind of the outliers, the extreme cases. It's for most of them, it's not that bad, but there are those extreme cases out there.
Right. And if you're expecting, you know, you're living on a fixed salary and you get paid every 2 weeks, suddenly you get paid monthly and it's 80%, 40% of what you were getting beforehand.
And no first supplemental.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's going to be a while before this gets better.
That's right. That's right.
What else is going on?
There is the decline in the federal workforce.
Oh, yeah, I've got it right in front of me here,
your
story.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics, every month they come out with their job numbers, their employment numbers. And the vast majority of the media looks at the overall employment figures. But you dig down in some of these BLS numbers, and there's some interesting month-by-month trends in the total population of the federal workforce. It's been declining considerably the last couple of years, and it's been declining pretty steadily. According to BLS numbers, the federal workforce is now 20% lower than it was in May 2010 when it hit its peak. Now, this includes postal workers, this includes intelligence workers, this includes foreigners who are employed overseas, often by DOD and state. So when you look at everything under the sun, the federal workforce is 20% lower than it was 3 years ago. And that is a considerable decline. Part of it is the dire straits the U.S. Postal Service is facing. They're losing billions of dollars. They are really frightened for the future of the Postal Service. And one of the ways that they've been trying to right their ship is by cutting their staffing. The Postal Service workforce is now at roughly 584,000 people. That's the lowest point in at least a decade. The BLS numbers only go back to 2003, and I could not find a lower Postal Service employment figure in those ranks.
I remember when it was 800,000 plus. I mean, you safely use that. When you're talking here about peak in May 2010 of 3.4 million employees, and that's, again, that's everybody, is that the absolute peak in federal employment ever, or is it just in recent times?
In at least a decade. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm sure it was bigger during the World War II and some of the back several during the Cold War when, you know, and during World War II when you have the proverbial rooms full of people, rooms full of clerks. So I know it has been higher, but in recent memory, that was that's the highest that it's been that I can recall.
Yeah, and I don't remember seeing that figure this big that's so all-inclusive of foreign nationals as well.
Yeah.
And it's funny when you do these numbers, everybody seems to pull them out of a different hat because – oftentimes, when you're trying to make the government look good, you exclude the Postal Service completely, you know, and it gets down to just barely over 2 million people.
And a lot of these figures, like the ones that OPM publishes on their website, you can drill down so they don't include things like the intelligence community because the CIA and the DIA, they don't want you knowing how many, you know, CIA folks they have.
I remember once years ago at the Washington Post, somebody couldn't get any numbers in the CIA, so they called the Soviet embassy, and they gave them a figure.
Good sourcing.
Yeah. Anything?
Well, another thing going on is DOD, the Defense Department. There's some renewed push to try to cut down on the number of civilian employees there. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure all over the government to pare down and shrink. And there does seem to be some special attention now being given to the Defense Department, which is fairly unusual. I mean, you know, I think it's just in the last couple of years we've been seeing, you know, open calls for shrinking the Defense Department, and you know, typically that was bread and butter, and any congressman who claimed to be patriotic would never touch the Defense Department. Things have changed.
Well, and the shift to Asia too, putting more of the fleet on the Pacific side and that kind of thing. And I want to ask you something. Yeah, a large group, part of your audience, large part of our audience, is contractors. Yeah. You know, they follow this because they work in tandem with government workers. They work when government workers work. This thing with Mr. Snowden and the NSA data information, you know, this is early days into this, quote, scandal, so we don't quite know a whole lot about it. But is this going to make things tougher for contractors, maybe politically tougher, and is it going to exacerbate there are existing tensions, as we all know, between contractors and civil servants? The feds think the contractors make the big bucks. Contractors think the feds live in a fireproof cocoon full of benefits. Is it going to be better or worse?
I think it will make things worse for contractors. It's certain to be a talking point for the next few years, you know, about the dangers of, you know, unaccountable contractors and so forth. But you know, the reality is that the government relies very heavily on contractors, particularly contractors like Booz Allen and others who get most of their revenue from the government. And that's because most of their employees are former feds who a lot of them have clearances and they have the skills and expertise to do a lot of the stuff that the federal government just cannot recruit people to do. For whatever reason, they certainly get paid a lot more as well as contractors. So there is this reliance that I don't see how you can break that. They need them to do their missions, and these are missions that are vital in national security. However, it will, I'm sure, fuel the debate over the size of the contractor workforce, accountability and transparency as it relates to the contractor workforce. So I expect to see a lot more of that, and obviously it's going to fuel a big debate over, you know, the broader question of privacy versus security.
Good, gentlemen, got the last word. Thank you, Steve Losey. Thank you, Steve Watkins. Well, we'll be back here next week. Have a good week.